Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, how ways of thinking and doing things get dug in over time, whether or not they're good for society. We'll spend this hour with Paul Starr, who teaches sociology and public affairs at Princeton, talking about the phenomenon of entrenchment, in which policies and beliefs put in place by one group of stakeholders are designed to be very resistant to change by another group, even within a democracy. We'll talk about why the United States succeeded in entrenching the abolition of slavery but has failed to entrench racial equality to this day. And we'll talk about the way entrenchment helps reinforce the advantages of the already wealthy and powerful. Our conversation starts after a short break. There are two kinds of politics in a democracy. In ordinary politics, political parties agree at least on the rules of engagement. They compete with the understanding that the winners get to set the agenda for as long as they hold a majority. Then there's the politics of entrenchment, where leaders start arguing over the rules themselves, and those who gain control use their power to make their policies nearly impossible to change. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The endless tug of war over ordinary politics can definitely be frustrating, but it's worth keeping in mind that the consequences of entrenchment politics can last a very long time, whether we think they're good for society or bad. Paul Starr is professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University. His new book is called Entrenchment: Wealth, Power, and the Constitution of Democratic Societies. Paul, welcome back to Think.
I'm delighted to be here, Chris.
You want us to understand that entrenchment is not a bad thing in and of itself. What's the good kind of entrenchment?
Well, a constitution is entrenched. If it's made hard to change, our constitution is very hard to amend. You need two-thirds of each House of Congress, and you then need to get three-quarters of the states to ratify an amendment. So lawyers talk about constitutional entrenchment, writing a rule in a form that makes it hard to change, and our Constitution is very important in protecting our freedom and many other important interests, rule of law, democracy, so forth. Our Constitution, however, also did protect slavery and indeed helped to entrench that for a good part of our history up till the Civil War. So entrenchment itself, per se, is neither good nor bad. It depends on exactly what it is, entrenching, and it also depends on your point of view.
It seemed the era after World War II represented an entrenchment of liberal democratic governance in many parts of the world. Why has that not been as robustly established as many people had hoped?
Well, during the period in the mid-20th century, I think if we look back at it, there was this era, really runs from World War I through the Depression, World War II, and the Cold War, when in all the Western governments, there was an expansion of government, of governmental capacities. And during that same period, there was a general trend toward greater equality. Now, some of that trend resulted from the destruction of great wealth during the Great Depression and during the World Wars. But for the decades immediately after World War II, you know, running into the mid-70s, that was really a period of peak equality in an economic sense. I mean, there were lots of other inequalities like racial inequality, but the distribution of income and wealth was relatively equal in the United States compared to earlier periods and unfortunately, compared to the period since then. So I think that helped to create a wider middle class. It helped to create a greater sense of shared prosperity. And that contributed, I think, to a stable set of institutions that were liberal democratic institutions. And then, you know, since then, we've had a lot more economic problems. We've had greater inequality in income and wealth. We've had a lot of disaffection as a result of changes that contributed to greater racial equality, greater gender equality. There's been a backlash against that. So you've got economic unhappiness. You've got the backlash. It's, I think, been destabilizing. And we're seeing that in the United States. We're seeing that in Western Europe and elsewhere, too.
We understand constitutional entrenchment. This is something that happens intentionally. How does it happen that entrenchment takes place almost by accident in some cases?
Yeah, okay. So I make a distinction between things that get entrenched because of the rules of change, mm-hmm. like the rules of constitutional amendments. So those are intentionally set up. They're deliberately set up. We expect a constitution to be difficult to change. But then some other things become difficult to change because of the costs of change. Oh, and especially when those costs fall on powerful people and institutions. So let me just take another example, and that is the costs of change to meet the issue of climate change, to deal with the threat of rising global temperatures and rising sea levels. Well, there's a question where, you know, we need to, I believe we need to change the organization of our power plants, power grid, the way factories work. It's a costly process. It's not unimaginable for us to do this. We've actually made a lot of progress in renewable energy, but that cost is a difficult one. It's going to fall on certain people, certain regions, and do we have the political capacity to surmount those costs of change? Well, the costs of change then help to entrench a pattern of energy use and other things. And so that's it's the same kind of issue, but it wasn't a matter of somebody intentionally making it hard to change.
Even a program like Social Security was not necessarily designed to be very hard to change. Today, few people would want to eliminate it, but it has been hard even to amend its terms over the years to make it financially sustainable.
Yeah, so that's a good example of where people have adjusted their lives with the expectation of Social Security and with the expectation of retirement. But before Social Security, there was no general expectation of retirement. And so many institutions, private corporations and ordinary people have planned out their lives with the expectation of retirement, and Social Security fits into that. And so once you adopt a system like that, yeah, it does. It becomes entrenched. It becomes very hard to change.
So you say that democracy abhors entrenched power. Isn't some degree of entrenchment essential for a democratic government to function?
Yes, yes. I when I said that, I meant that what we abhor is the idea that the power of incumbents will be entrenched, so that we expect that a democracy will create the possibility that the electorate can throw the bums out, can decide not to reelect people. So in that sense, entrenchment, I think, is really at odds with the basic idea of democracy. But we need entrenched institutions. Those institutions do have to have certain powers, certain authority. All of that is absolutely necessary for democracy.
Right, because entrenched rules protect the weak against the powerful.
Sometimes, yes. Sometimes. We hope they do.
How does lock-in work?
Okay, so I use the term lock-in for situations where things get entrenched because of those high costs of change. And so you get, for example, patterns of production that I was mentioning before that get kind of locked in. And then there are other things that get locked in because of extraordinary moments. There are moments of crisis. Wartime is a good example. When policies get adopted, expedients get adopted, and they get locked in. It becomes harder to change them afterward once people get used to them. This is what I think happened, during the world wars that brought about fundamental changes in government, in taxes, so forth, and those changes did to some extent get locked in. Now, over long enough periods of change, they do change, and whenever I use these terms. Entrenchment or lock-in, I don't mean forever. I just mean they create a big barrier to change. But they can break and they do break down.
So even something like the Patriot Act might be an example of that.
Yes, I think that is an example of something of a change adopted at a moment of crisis that has lasting consequences.
So what effect does entrenchment have on our thinking about what is and what is not possible within any specific democracy? How does entrenchment affect what we wish for?
Yeah, so I think we're making estimates all the time about what is within the range of the possible. And those estimates change. We have seen some things that perhaps we thought were unchangeable break open and no longer be as certain as we thought. In fact, I think a lot of things have seem more fragile today than they did only a few years ago. So this is always up for negotiation, but you know, there are certain things that are just harder to change. I mean, let's just take an example of something that has had enormous consequences for our politics, the Electoral College. So that's a constitutional provision, which I think it'd be hard to justify today if we were starting out fresh. That is, if we didn't have this in the Constitution today, would we enact this all over again? But there it is. And it has had an enormous impact in both 2000 and 2016. The popular vote was effectively overridden by this really archaic provision in our Constitution.
Why would the creators of entrenched policies pre-commit to future limitations, which make it harder not just for their adversaries to change things, but limit their own power to change things?
Yeah, so I think that's a terrific question. And so here you come to one of the basic questions about constitutional government. You know, why does any government adopt a constitution that limits its own power? And we sometimes recognize that at a later moment we won't be entirely ourselves. We won't be faithful to our own true beliefs. We might give in to some temptation. Let me just take a prosaic example. You may put the alarm clock far enough away from your bed so that when it goes off, you don't, in a kind of half doze, shut it off and go back to sleep.
Yeah.
You know, you force yourself to do certain things. We do this all the time in our personal lives. We force ourselves, we pre-commit to doing something we're afraid we might not do at another moment. And I think this is the best interpretation of a constitution, that the framers of a constitution recognize that at some later moment, there'll be a temptation to deny people their just rights, their liberties, and consequently a constitution has to restrain the government. I think that's the good way in which this happens. But very often, such provisions are adopted to handcuff later generations and to deny opponents ever the ability to change things around. So it's not always for the best possible reasons.
How does that kind of thinking relate to whatever position we might take on constitutional originalism?
Well, there's a lot of argument about this. By originalism, do you mean the original intent, what the people may have had in mind?
The sort of Scalia-style originalism, well, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's the textual kind, where you say it's the words themselves and what they meant, not necessarily what was in the minds of the people at the time. And, we have such a changed world today. We have to pay attention to the text, but we also have to pay attention to the realities of the world we live in. And so, for example, when we think about a problem like climate change, for which there was really no analog in the 18th century, when we think about the technologies that we have today, we have to adjust for the world we live in.
My guest is Paul Starr. He's professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University and author of a new book called Entrenchment: Wealth, Power, and the Constitution of Democratic Societies. You can join us by calling 800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University, Paul Starr. His new book is called Entrenchment: Wealth, Power, and the Constitution of Democratic Societies. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can email think@kera.org or call 800-933-5372. Paul, you note in the book that the Union's victory in the Civil War managed to entrench the abolition of slavery. Why have we been unable to entrench fundamental racial equality in America?
Oh, well, there was a huge legacy of slavery that could only have been overcome with the most extraordinary commitment by the Union in the years after the Civil War toward education, toward changing the distribution of land, and it would have been an enormous undertaking to reverse the inequalities that had been established under decades, actually centuries, of slavery. And there was a moment in that period during Reconstruction when it seemed as though the Union was going to undertake very fundamental changes in Southern society. And of course, there was resistance against that, and the resistance ultimately triumphed, and Reconstruction came to an end.
Slavery itself, of course, started as a social practice before it was ever recognized or codified in European law or in American law. What is the difference between a society with slaves and a slave society?
Okay. So, that's a distinction that actually comes from the analysis of slavery in the ancient world, but it also applies to the American colonies and the early American Republic. And a slave society is one where slavery is fundamental to the society. It's integral to the society. It's integral to its economy and its social relations. And the Southern colonies, and particularly those in the Deep South at that time, developed into slave societies where slavery was integral to the whole way the social system worked. There was, in fact, slavery in New England, in the middle colonies, but those were more societies with slaves. The number of slaves was much smaller than in the Southern colonies, and the economies in the North and the societies were not built around slavery in the way that they were in the South. So that created the basis of what happened then during the Revolutionary period. So there was, at the time of the American Revolution, a lot of questioning of slavery. Some of that questioning, in fact, coming from free blacks who began to have a voice of their own, but also from many others who saw the contradiction between the ideals that Americans were expressing in the Revolution and the actual practice of slavery. And in the North, in the Northern states, in the years during the Revolutionary era and immediately after, slavery began to be abolished. And what happened, of course, is that two different kinds of society developed in the United States between the North and the South. The free states and the slave states were very fundamentally different in how they worked economically. And so this is one of the parts of the book. I think it's actually one of the most interesting parts of the book, is the whole question of why slavery became entrenched in the South, did not become entrenched in the North, the struggle then over the Western states, which would become free states, which would become slave states, and the implications that this had for the United States as a whole, for the way our institutions developed. Because you go back to the very beginning, you go back to the Revolution and the Constitution, there were many choices that were being made where slavery was, in fact, central to the whole thinking about, for example, about the rights of the states. And so many people think that states' rights were all about protecting freedom. Actually, states' rights were a lot about protecting slavery to begin with.
All right, I want to go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also find us on Twitter at KERA Think. We have Benny on the line in Dallas. Hi, Benny.
Yeah, hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
I have a question for him. I feel like corporations here in the United States play a big role in, they always left out of the conversation. And I wonder why is that, and if he noticed that. And I also would like him to talk about, he talked about the cause for acting on climate change. But what about the cause for no acting?
All right, thanks for calling. So the power of corporations, Paul, in the United States, and how that plays into electoral power, and then also this question of the cost of changing the way we deal with the climate.
I think there's no doubt about it that the great corporations in the United States have an extraordinary amount of power and influence, that's going to affect the whole issue of climate change. It's affected the whole understanding of the problem because the energy companies invested in creating doubt as to whether or not this was really happening. And so they've affected the whole political debate in the country about this issue. So, yeah, that's unquestionably a factor.
How significant is the entrenchment of electoral rules? You mentioned the Electoral College earlier, but electoral rules in the way that power and also policy become calcified over time.
Okay, so this is another aspect of entrenchment, and it has to do here with the way we conduct elections, the rules that we use to decide who wins elections. And so there are two basic systems of electoral rules that exist in the major democracies of the world. And those two different sets of rules have created two different kinds of party systems and different politics. So we're used to a system where you have electoral districts, like congressional districts, where there's a single winner, and whoever has a plurality wins the election. Don't necessarily have to win a majority, just a plurality. That's called first past the post. But in many other democracies, there's a system called proportional representation. And candidates don't run individually in districts. They run as a slate or groups, and representation is awarded proportionally. Now, you might think that's just a technical aspect, but it has a huge impact. In the United States and other countries that use this first-past-the-post system, you get a two-party system. It's often just not rational, not sensible to vote for a third party because you're just going to, quote, waste your vote. Mm-hmm. So very few people vote for a third party. So you get two big parties. But when you have proportional representation, well, then you get third parties and fourth parties, and you get a whole different kind of politics that results from that. So the two-party system in the United States is something that has an effect, become entrenched. It becomes entrenched because if you're in one of the two parties, you don't really want to open up a path for third parties and fourth parties. So there's very little support for turning from this kind of system we have to proportional representation. They're just extraordinary implications for what happens in the United States, just very briefly. This has to do with political geography. So in the United States right today, Democratic votes are concentrated in big cities. Rural areas are mostly Republican. And the suburbs are the most actively contested. And that produces a particular pattern to our politics. But if we, you know, if you turn to other countries with proportional representation, things don't look like that at all. They don't divide up in this geographical way and have the same effects.
But can proportional representation and like single member districts both be used to help existing elites hang on to their power?
Yeah. Well, in both cases, you know, once you have a system of a particular kind of electoral system, it will tend to generate parties that want to keep things the way they are. Right. You go down one road, and I try to tell the story of how this happened in different countries that have ended up with different electoral systems and different parties, and that gets perpetuated over time. So this is an example of entrenchment. It's different from other kinds that we've been talking about, but it's one that has huge effects for the way politics works.
It feels as if the platforms and policies of the two major parties in this country, Democrats and Republicans, are pretty entrenched. Is that actually accurate over the long term?
Oh, well, no. I mean, these two, even though we've had a two-party system from pretty much from the very beginning, the parties have changed a great deal. You know, the Democratic and Republican parties have been in place ever since the 1850s, 1860s, but their political positions have evolved a great deal. They've always been coalitions, but the basis of those coalitions has shifted dramatically. I mean, I think the most dramatic change, and everybody would grant, is that the South that used to be all Democratic has become almost entirely Republican. How did that happen? Well, that's a major transformation that's especially taken place really since the middle of the 20th century.
What moves parties off of their longstanding positions to something new? Is it typically done deliberately, or is it something that sort of happens without the people in charge necessarily acknowledging that this is taking place?
Well, the political parties exist within societies where the economy is shifting, where the population is changing, new immigrant groups arrive, processes like urbanization take place, massive changes are going on, and the parties have to adjust to those realities. They can't just stand still. And you know, we have seen again with the just thinking about the period since the mid 20th century, the emergence of new forces. I'm particularly thinking now about the civil rights movement, about the women's movement, that have altered politics dramatically, and consequently, the political parties have adjusted, and the lines of division have changed dramatically. So, just to get back to the theme here, so we have a two-party system that's entrenched, but despite that, there's a lot of change taking place. And again, I don't mean entrenchment to mean there's no change. I don't mean to mean that everything's permanent. But there are certain structures or patterns that tend to remain in place over long periods of time.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, what role does the Supreme Court play in the politics of entrenchment, Paul?
A huge role, because that very concise constitution of ours has a lot of passages that are indeed open to interpretation. Indeed, there's no way that they could not be subject to interpretation. And so the court is enormously important. I think most Americans understand that is a central point of contention in how our society is going to move in the future. And, you know, just thinking about 2020 and beyond, we now have a court that's 5-4, a conservative majority. If President Trump is reelected, I think he'll very likely get to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer, possibly. So we could go from 5-4 conservative to 7-2 conservative. Now, conservatives would be delighted by that. Liberals are going to be appalled by that. From the point of view, from just going back to the subject of entrenchment, I think that would entrench a conservative majority for quite a while and lead to pretty fundamental changes in constitutional law.
What do you think the United States would look like with a Supreme Court that had that kind of majority, reliable majority, where swing votes even cease to be a problem?
Well, okay, so I think you also have to put that against the other changes that are taking place in this country demographically and socially. Democrats have won the popular vote in 6 out of the last 7 presidential elections. Now, they haven't won the presidency in all those cases because of the Electoral College. It's a result of that outcome that that the Supreme Court is moving in this direction. But I think it's really not the same direction as our society is moving. And so I think there's going to be a big gap between public opinion and a Supreme Court that goes as far to the right as it may well go.
To the extent that Democrats might like to change the electoral rules so that the Electoral College wasn't the final decision maker, but in fact the popular vote was, can you just kind of explain for us how entrenched systems as they exist today make that really, really difficult?
Yeah, well, again, this goes back to the difficulty of a constitutional amendment where, you know, two-thirds of each House of Congress, 3/4 of the states need to ratify. That's an enormous hurdle. We've actually had amazingly few amendments to the Constitution in our history. And there really hasn't been a major amendment now. It depends what you consider a major amendment. I guess the 18-year-old vote, I think that was a major amendment. That was in the early 1970s. So we've gone really more than 40 years without a major amendment. There was one minor amendment in there. So it's really hard, and I don't see any prospect of a constitutional amendment abolishing the Electoral College. Some people have the idea that there's another way around that. I don't think that's going to work. So that's pretty much entrenched for as long as I can imagine.
My guest is Paul Starr. He's professor of sociology and of public affairs at Princeton University. We're talking about his new book, Entrenchment: Wealth, Power, and the Constitution of Democratic Societies. We'll come back to this conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter. We're @KERAThink. Boyd. My guest this hour is Paul Starr, professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University and author of Entrenchment: Wealth, Power, and the Constitution of Democratic Societies. You can join us by calling 800-933-5372. That's where we hear from Eric in Dallas. Hello, Eric.
Hello. I wanted to ask your guest, since we're in the first-past-the-post election type, in Maine or Vermont now, they allow you to place your first, second, and third choices. And if your first guy doesn't win, then they go to your second guy. And it's also done in England that way. And it's kind of a hybrid between the two. And I'm wondering what he thinks, and especially how he thinks that might play out if applied to the primaries upcoming, where we've got 20-some candidates going, and that's my question.
Thanks for calling.
Right, it's Maine that's adopted ranked choice voting, and I think it is in many ways a better way for people to vote. It allows people to vote for a third party candidate or an independent candidate, without feeling that they would be entirely wasting their vote, because what will happen in the end is, if in a close election where neither of the first two candidates wins a majority, is that those votes for the candidates at the bottom get reallocated in line with what the voter's second choice was, or possibly the third choice, depending on, you know, on the on the list of candidates. And so that produces a result that is actually a better reflection of what the public as a whole wants. We actually just had the first congressional race, I think, ever determined by ranked choice up in Maine, in Maine's second district. So, yeah, that's a good idea. Now, as for applying that to the Democratic primaries in 2020, well, that's not going to happen because that hasn't been provided for. It's not in the rules. The rules have already been adopted. So, it might have been a good idea. But I don't think it's going to happen. I think also, actually, when you get to 20 candidates, it's very hard for people to start ranking them. This works a lot better, I think, when you're just talking about three or four or maybe five candidates. But you know, for people who don't follow these things closely, when they're looking at 20 possible candidates to rank, what may happen is a lot of people just don't vote. They're just confused. And so it works, I think, better if you have some kind of threshold for getting in, like, you know, candidates to qualify for the ballot have to have a certain number of petitions signed or something that's a higher threshold. So it becomes more manageable for people to figure out how they want to do the ranking.
The Federal Reserve System is absolutely entrenched in our society and our economy. Is this a check on the autonomy of democratic governments?
Yeah, so I think the Federal Reserve is an example of a central bank with a great deal of autonomy, and there is evidence that independent central banks have contributed to price stability. They've reduced the possibilities of inflation, so there's a reasonable economic case for that kind of independent power. But there's also no question that independent central banks limit the power of the elected leaders. And in some countries, there's so much independence granted, not just to the Federal Reserve, but to other bureaucracies, that the public may believe that the government is not really being very responsive to them, that so much of the government is off limits, that elected leaders are really so hemmed in. And I think that's part of the problem that people are having, you know, with the European Union, sense that Brussels bureaucracy is so unaccountable. So there's a balance to be struck here. I think, you know, you do need independent professional decision making in many parts of government. Most of us want the Centers for Disease Control to be run professionally by people who know the science. I'd really rather not have Congress interfering with the details of decision making about medical issues. It's just better to have the professionals doing that, and the same in a number of other areas. But there comes a point, I think, when the voters believe they properly have to have the final decision.
We've talked mostly today about domestic politics. How does entrenchment work on the international stage?
Yeah, so some things can be entrenched through international treaties. And in some cases, governments may use treaties as a way to entrench things domestically. So they sign a treaty and then they say to their opponents domestically, oh, really, there's nothing we can do about it. We signed a treaty already. Now, there are good and bad aspects to that. At the end of World War II, the United States created a number of international institutions, entered into various treaties that I think contributed to a long period of peace. I mean, there have been other wars since then, but on the whole have contributed to international peace and stability. So I'm not against international treaties, but then there are examples. I think this is true of some of the economic agreements that have been used to override domestic politics, and in particular have been used by corporate interests to limit demands for environmental and consumer interests, and those are a real problem.
Yes, and of course, this idea of international treaties being used to, sort of discourage opposition to policies domestically makes me think again about, the treaties made with regard to climate policy. The U.S., had it sort of followed through with the Paris Agreement, would have had to make changes that now it's not holding itself to.
Right. Right. And there are obvious disagreements about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, so we didn't, I think, obligate ourselves in the Paris Agreement to do very much. The real questions about climate change were going to come up, I think, beyond the Paris Agreement.
What does resistance to wealth distribution, even among Americans who might be expected to benefit from it, have to do with our racial and ethnic diversity?
We were talking earlier about the Civil War and about slavery and about the legacies of slavery. And one of those legacies has to do with the distribution of wealth. Slaves obviously could not accumulate wealth. After the Civil War, there were hints that they'd be given 40 acres and a mule, but in fact there was no redistribution of land to the slaves who had worked without being paid for generations. And so the possibilities for wealth accumulation were limited at the very beginning, and those inequalities have remained. We have just extraordinary disparities in wealth racially in the United States, and it all goes back. It goes back to slavery. It goes back to Jim Crow. It goes back to policies that were adopted about mortgages. We had institutions that were very, very unfavorable to the accumulation of wealth by African Americans. So yes, we are living with that entrenched pattern in the United States, and it is properly an issue to be considered politically.
But the U.S. did entrench a number of progressive reforms in the first half of the 20th century.
Yes, yes. And this is also part of this book, Entrenchment, because I'm concerned to look on both sides. And so on the one hand, we have the entrenched power of concentrated wealth, but we also do have entrenched reforms. You mentioned Social Security, which has been very important in providing a basis for a retirement and support for people with disabilities, and then with Medicare providing for healthcare as well, and those programs have been established in a way that has in fact entrenched them. It's they haven't been repealed when parties change. When government changes hands, and So it's not impossible to entrench progressive changes, that is, changes that benefit people of low and moderate incomes. We still have progressive income tax in the United States. Amazingly, after all the changes that have been made to water it down, it still is a progressive income tax. And that, to me, is a good example of a kind of entrenchment that has benefited people who are not at the top.
Paul, when our party, whichever we favor, is in control, it can be really tempting to make a lot of big changes that the opposing party can't undo without a great deal of difficulty, even if they achieve a majority in the future. Would you caution us about entrenching policies that we sincerely believe to be good for the country?
So I think there's a difference when a policy becomes entrenched because it's popular and people support it and they rely on it and they have every reason to believe it will be there for them. It will continue. And again, come back to the example of Social Security. So I don't think there was anything wrong in the way that was established, although once it was established, it did become hard to undo. I think what we have to worry about is the entrenchment of policies that are unpopular, that people would like to change but can't change. And that's where democracy gets undermined. I think that's the distinction we have to make.
So what power do we have as individual Americans to make those changes?
Well, the power we have is primarily the power that we have at the ballot box, but also to protest, to agitate, to to do that, I should say, also at the local level as well as the national level. I mean, there are enormous opportunities in local government. Local elections are. Have very low participation in many parts of the country, incredibly low turnout. It's actually not that hard, I think, for people to get together who share beliefs and to make a difference in the way things are run.
So this book is mostly about U.S. history and politics, but you have familiarity with a lot of political systems around the world. Would you say that U.S. politics is significantly more or less entrenched than other constitutional democracies?
Well, we have, just if we're talking about constitutions, we actually have one of the oldest constitutions in the world that's been continually in force. And it is an extraordinary testament to the founders that that document from 1787 should still be the basis of our governmental system here so many years later. One of the reasons we have it is that it has been a platform for change. It has enabled peaceful change over time, so that we haven't had violent revolutions. That is the kind of entrenchment that that you want. So you have a structure that's resilient enough that is able to accommodate. New beliefs, new ways of doing things, it's that guarantee of stability that actually also makes possible change. It's that kind of combination.
Paul Starr is professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University. His new book is called Entrenchment: Wealth, Power, and the Constitution of Democratic Societies. Paul, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thanks very much for making time for us.
Thank you, Chris.
You can follow us on Facebook and also on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @KERAThink. Mine is @ChrisBoydThink. You can use your favorite podcast app to subscribe to the Think podcast and find out about upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.